Our top story this week, in a stunning announcement, President Stevenson declares he will resign from the office of the presidency. The news came in a television address to the nation last night and leaves John Stevenson as only the second president in the country's history to voluntarily leave the White House without finishing his term of office. The news has created a firestorm of activity among the politicos as speculation grows about how this could affect next year's presidential election. Tensions escalated this week in Asia, following an announcement from the Russian Federation that they will be holding the cargo ship Autumn Dawn in quarantine in the port city of Vladivostok indefinitely. Despite protests by the People's Republic of China, the infected American ship, with its cargo of grain, soybeans, and corn paid for by the Chinese government, continues to be a source of stress, boiling over this week as nations traded barbs and accusations. RLA's Chuck Fleming is at the State Department and will bring us the latest. A special conference committee of the House of Representatives began reviewing the 21st Century Homestead Act this week. Viewed as an opportunity to provide housing and a fresh start for those that escaped dead cities, the bill would look to find new residents for unclaimed housing in Miami-Dade County following the recent outbreak that nearly destroyed the city and resulted in the loss of millions of Floridians. Our correspondent, Kate Malik, will be reporting on this story from the nation's capital. Move over, Labradoodle and Cockapoo. Designer dogs are all the rage again. But in pandemic society, America's taste in man's best friend has made a big turn from the cute and fluffy to the reliable and functional. We'll visit a dog breeder in Massachusetts that's cashing in on the new cottage industry of pets approved for the reanimate threat. Finally, at today's RLA discussion table, we'll be joined by our Washington contributors to discuss the deteriorating situation in Asia. We'll address the state of current affairs, possible outcomes, and the role of the United States in this developing crisis. You're listening to Radio Living America, and I'm your host, Brian Andrews. Our program begins in Washington, D.C., where President Stevenson announced in a television appearance to the nation yesterday that he will be resigning from the nation's executive office. Mired in controversy over his handling of the pandemic, the chorus of criticism had reached a crescendo when he failed to act during the crisis in Miami, leaving the city to mount its own defense, supplied not by federal relief, but instead by its own resourcefulness and the initiative of its neighbors. Most Beltway pundits saw his re-election prospects as weak, and some even suggested that he might not seek his party's nomination for a second term. But in a stunning move, John Stevenson declared he will be resigning his position as President of the United States. Not since the resignation of Richard Nixon in 1974 has a president voluntarily left the White House without finishing his term. The president took a sober tone as he addressed the nation.
My fellow Americans, for over 30 years, I have served this country as a senator, a governor, and now as its president. When I took the oath of office, not yet 3 years ago, I swore to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States to the best of my ability. The reanimating pandemic has brought a new type of threat to our country.
A date which will live in infamy.
To the very existence of our species, the likes of which humankind has never seen. It was my intention, my strongest impulse, to steer our country through this crisis.
In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation.
But I fear there has been an erosion of confidence in my presidency so thorough, so profound, even within my own party, that the best of my abilities will not be adequate for the American people. America deserves a full-time president and a full-time Congress. The office of the presidency is bigger than any one person or party, and with so much at stake here at home, this office must be one that instills confidence. It is for this reason that I have chosen to resign my position as your president.
With America's future under challenge right here at home, with our hopes and the world's hopes for peace and the balance every day.
and I will be leaving office at the end of September.
The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave.
It is my greatest desire that America will move forward with a renewed commitment and a new unity, that the people of this country will steel their resolve and overcome this new and awful threat. May God bless the American people, and God bless the United States of America.
The president's decision has prompted wild conjecture about what this means for next year's election, with politicos speculating on rivals and even the possibility of a primary challenge within the president's own party. While not officially announcing her candidacy, California Governor Laura Chen did not hide her intentions in comments she made following the president's address.
This is a sobering moment for the country, and I think it shows all of us just how heavy the weight of the presidency can be during a time of crisis. Resigning from office, while a very solemn decision, is still the right decision for America. The American people need a leader who can bring the entire nation together and lead the country through this crisis with the determination and courage the United States deserves.
At the end of the month, John Stevenson will leave Washington on board Marine One as President of the United States and arrive at his home in Rhinebeck, New York, a private citizen. But with House investigations still ongoing regarding his handling of the crisis, the president could still face legal problems relating to his tenure in the White House. Ohio Congresswoman Mary Walters took a break from a House investigation this morning to talk to reporters.
What we're learning from this investigation into the government's failure to support Miami is the president was very fond of telling Congress one thing and doing something entirely different. I think we need to broaden our analysis of the president's actions to not just include Miami, but his whole response to the crisis. I'd be very interested to subpoena witnesses who were involved in the president's decision-making going all the way back to Los Angeles.
When President Stevenson does resign, Vice President Brownard will be elevated to president and will have the opportunity to pick a new vice president. Next, we turn to the tension rising in the Far East that continues to build as the Russian Federation continues to quarantine the American cargo ship, Autumn Dawn. Experts argue that the ship, which was on its way to China when its crew fell victim to the RADM virus and was recovered by the Russian Navy, should have been released from quarantine weeks ago. Chinese officials had offered to reclaim the ship with no quarantine period and assume responsibility for it, but Russia refuses to release the vessel from its naval base at the Pacific port of Vladivostok. RLA's Chuck Fleming is at the State Department in Washington, D.C. with the latest.
Brian, tensions are running high here at the State Department. The week began with a press briefing by Secretary of State Tillman.
A reasonable period of quarantine has come and gone, and the Russian Navy must release this ship. The United States flag it flies under and the property of the People's Republic of China that it carries in its hold must be respected. Russia's actions are taking on the qualities of a confiscation, and it is creating an environment of escalating tension so severe that we may soon reach a point where political dialogue can no longer continue.
This comes as the British Prime Minister said there was no excuse to not release the ship, and the Prime Minister of Australia condemned the Russian government for unnecessarily escalating tensions in the region. A stronger response came from Canada, whose port city of Vancouver has avoided the contamination seen in the western United States and currently stands as the most commercially active port facility on North America's Pacific coast, doing a brisk trade with China for Canada's agricultural industry. The Canadian Prime Minister threatened to withdraw their embassy staff in St. Petersburg, clearly uneasy that Canadian ships bound for China, which have to pass near Russian territorial waters, could be the next to find themselves arbitrarily quarantined in Vladivostok. But of all the commentary out of the global community, there was no greater rebuke than that made by China, as evidenced by a statement made here in Washington by Ambassador Li Weizheng.
The People's Republic will not sit idly by while the Russian Federation inverts the black and white. There is already enough problems troubling the world without these provocations from our Western neighbor. Our messages are plain. Release the ship. Release the ship and release it now, or we will consider it a violation of the Sino-Russia Treaty of Friendship. While all the nations of the world sacrificing to stamp out the Rhenium flame, Russia choose to engage in a selfish instigations. I ask, Where's their conscience? For every day the Russian Federation holds this ship, the People's Republic will deliver 100 days of sorrow.
In his weekly press briefing with reporters, Joint Chiefs Chairman William Abibio was asked on the matter, and his response did little to inspire hope.
General, what do you think of the increasingly tense rhetoric between Russia and China? Could this be escalating to a point of armed conflict?
We certainly hope not. Every country needs to focus on the reanimate threat, and Russia and China are no different. That said, our latest intelligence indicates that military forces in the region are being diverted from the lines of engagement on the pandemic front to take up a more hostile posture along the Russia-China border and in the region in general.
Can you be more specific about your observations, General?
Earlier in the week, a reconnaissance outpost on Japan's northernmost island spotted three destroyers, a frigate, and one cruiser of the Russian Federation Navy traveling east through the Soyuz Strait towards trade routes in the northwestern Pacific Ocean. Our intelligence also indicates that there has been a massive increase in Russian rail traffic heading east on the Trans-Siberian Railway to Vladivostok. And for their part, China has seen increased rail traffic from all over the northeastern part of the country to Hunchun and Dongfanghong. These cities are along the Russian border just north of North Korea and are the nearest Chinese cities to Vladivostok. It is our concern that these are troop trains, and what we are witnessing is a dangerous concentration of military assets along that border.
Now, Brian, the Russians have been very tight-lipped on the situation since their last press briefing immediately following their discovery of the Autumn Dawn. In a sparsely worded press release issued this morning by the Russian embassy here in Washington, the Russian ambassador wrote, "The pandemic has not stopped Russia from conducting routine naval exercises at our Pacific ports. We believe any increased tension in the region is a byproduct of a misinformation campaign by the United States, and we would hope that China, our valued neighbor to the east, would not fall victim to Western deceptions." Brian, concerns are growing that this could develop into something much bigger than a cargo ship. And if something doesn't happen to defuse the situation, Russia and China could quickly find themselves in a two-front war. Reporting for Radio Living America in Washington, D.C., I'm Chuck Fleming.
When we return, city planners in Miami, Florida draw inspiration from a 19th century pioneer act to repopulate the newly liberated city.
I've been at my job for 15 years and always tried to mind my own business. But last year, I encouraged my company to set up a recycling drive. Now we recycle every tin can, every piece of aluminum foil, even drippings from our meat rations. It's hard to remember the way we squandered resources before the pandemic, but now we try to remember that every M777 howitzer that keeps us safe is more than 9,300 pounds of metal and rubber.
Did you know that the Army's new 155mm anti-personnel Weeblos round was named after my scout troop did a scrap metal drive in our town in New York that broke the record for salvaging tungsten? We're going to do another drive this year, and I can't wait to hear what they name the round after we break the record again.
My wife is always on my case about not recycling my empty beer cans. She'd always complain about the garbage bags full of cans taking up too much space in the garage and how it always attracted the raccoons and the bees. But I was saving those cans for a reason. And I always thought that when I died, I would leave them to the kids. But when I found out that the military was converting all their artillery carriages to aluminum from steel, I decided it was time to give the old lady what she wanted and do my part to back the attack.
Family, friends, and neighbors are all trying to do their part in the pandemic war. Contact your local Office of Strategic Resources to see how you can make a difference and back the attack.
We return to Washington, D.C., where the mayor of Miami arrived this week to work with lawmakers on a bill that would redistribute unclaimed property in the newly liberated city. Following the successful counteroffensive there, Congress is looking to the 19th Century Homestead Act as a model to repopulate the city, with the hope that it will prove to be the template for liberated cities to come. Our Kate Malik, who traveled from South Florida with the mayor and his delegation, brings us the latest.
I'm here in front of the Capitol building, where lawmakers appear today as a new bill was introduced.
This being the day fixed by law 22-274, pursuant to House rules.
The chamber recognizes the representative from Florida.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. With the introduction of this bill, we seek to create an opportunity for displaced Americans to come to Southern Florida and pick up where their countrymen unfortunately had to leave off. We hope to provide an opportunity to inhabit what currently appears to be 500,000 vacant homes in Miami-Dade County.
What lawmakers are debating is a 21st century version of the Homestead Act, a law originally introduced by President Abraham Lincoln in some of the darkest days of the American Civil War. In its original introduction, the law was intended to provide pioneers with an avenue to land ownership, allocating 160 acres in exchange for a promise to farm and develop the land. The 21st century version would look to find new residents for the hundreds of thousands of homes that currently sit vacant in Miami-Dade County, their previous owners having fallen victim to the pandemic. I had a chance to catch up with Mayor Vasquez earlier today between sessions. Mayor Vasquez, what provisions are you looking to see in this bill?
The city planners and I have been working hard with our congressional representatives, and we think there's a really great opportunity to get Miami back on its feet while helping out some of our countrymen who have been displaced from dead cities. Some of the things we want to put in the bill would include mandatory occupancy for at least 10 years. And anyone who participates has to make improvements to the home and property. Look, Kate, you were there. Some of these places are in bad shape after weeks of heavy fighting. And we want to attract people who are going to take pride in the city and return Miami to the beautiful city it was just a handful of months ago.
Mayor Vasquez, what plans do you have to distribute the various properties?
Well, that's still being negotiated. But what I'd like to see is a distribution based on what value proposition an incoming resident brings to Miami. Look, first and foremost, we're going to take care of the veterans of our defense forces and anyone who came down with the C-lift and participated in the defense of the city. After that, I think we'll be giving priority to people with backgrounds in fields like engineering, medicine, construction, people with backgrounds in logistics. You get the picture. With many of these dead cities, it appears most of those that escaped were the wealthiest residents. I want to make this clear. People aren't going to be able to just buy their way into Miami. This is going to be a merit-based system. Let me put it this way. I don't think we're going to need any stockbrokers or social media influencers for quite a while.
The mayor cut our conversation short as he had to attend a finance committee meeting to discuss government assistance to the new pioneers of Miami to help them make the improvements he had referenced. Just who is allocated what is going to be an interesting proposition with millions of displaced Americans from fallen cities such as Los Angeles, Houston, and San Francisco potentially applying for a homestead. Just to give you an example of how diverse the Miami market can be, before the wildfire outbreak, the median home price in the city's Tony Coconut Grove district was just over $600,000, with many homes valued at millions of dollars, while the nearby neighborhood of Alapata saw a median home price of just over $100,000. If the mayor gets his way, we could see a complete inversion of the demographic makeup of Miami's neighborhoods from their pre-pandemic state. Reporting from the Capitol Building in Washington, D.C., I'm Kate Malik.
Researchers believe it has been at least 15,000 years since humankind domesticated the first gray wolf, predating any other animal domestication, or even our earliest attempts at agriculture. But humanity's partnership with dogs has manifested itself in many ways over the centuries, and nowhere has that been truer than in the United States. Hunting dogs such as spaniels, beagles, and hounds were the it dogs of colonial America. This trend would continue into the 19th century with pugs and terriers also gaining in popularity. The prosperity of the 20th century would see the rise of the classic American family dog, with collies, poodles, and retrievers becoming an inseparable part of many families. But Americans' taste in canine companions has made a quick 180-degree turn in a world full of the reanimated. While the canine world started the 21st century reflecting the excess and vanity of the country with designer dogs being the craze, now a breeder in Massachusetts is doing a brisk business capitalizing on her evolving partnership with man's best friend. Our Laura Sanders has the story.
I'm here in Westfield, Massachusetts, a small city in the Pioneer Valley about 100 miles west of Boston. When Lawrence Coffin founded the Berkshire Kennels here 60 years ago, he was largely breeding family dogs like Golden Retrievers, Black and Golden Labs, and Springer Spaniels. But for the last 20 years, his son Patrick has been running this family business. In that time, he's seen some big changes in America's taste in furry friends, and now finds himself at the center of a canine gold rush. Patrick, tell us how you've seen demand change in the history of this business.
Well, as you mentioned, Dad started mostly with family dogs. We still do a little bit of that today, but it started tailing off about 25 years ago, right about the time I took over the business. I made a big push to get us into the designer dogs, which was really taking off and eating into the traditional household dog market.
So how did your business change?
Well, we started doing a lot of cockapoos and labradoodles. We had a great business going for a while on the schnoodles and the Yorkie-poos, and even produced a few litters of Maltipoos. We experimented with some breeds of our own and tried to introduce a Yorkie schnoodle poo and a Labra-Yorkie doodle. But when you're crossing that many breeds, it's tough to generate a consistent product.
And how has the pandemic changed your business?
Well, we have a big advantage here because when my dad started the business, he got a bunch of contracts from the Massachusetts State Police for their canine unit. And he used that as the backbone to create another line of business, providing working dogs for security services. So we've always bred and trained German Shepherds, Dobermans, Bull Mastiffs, a few different kind of hound dogs, that sort of thing.
So what are the most popular breeds you're seeing Americans buy today?
Well, for the home market, we have a lot of success with breeds that have the size and power of an attack dog, but can still interact with the family.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. This is Daisy. She's a one-year-old Basset Pinscher. She's big, easy to socialize, powerful, and she has a sense of smell 1,000 times better than a human, so she can smell a reanimate coming from miles away. We're just finishing up training with her, and then she's going to a family in Marblehead.
And how much would a dog like this cost me?
This dog's $40,000, fully trained. Well, you know, for the family market, we're always trying to keep that balance where the dog's aggressive, but not too aggressive. I mean, this thing needs to be able to hang out with the kids. So we're also breeding a lot of Labrador Mastiffs and German Retrievers. We have more aggressive dogs, but they're reserved exclusively for the military market. We have a partnership with the U.S. military where we provide them with all our weapons-grade canines, and they send us members of their penal battalions for training purposes.
I understand you have a demonstration for us?
We do. This is Brownie. She's an 11-month-old German Ovcharka. That's a cross between one of our larger German Shepherds and a Caucasian Ovcharka.
Get your ass in there, Andrew.
Oh, come on, man. What the fuck?
Wow, that's a big dog.
Yeah, she's not quite fully grown either. At maturity, she'll stand about 6.5 feet tall on her hind legs and weigh over 200 pounds.
I'm not familiar with the Caucasian Ovcharka.
It's a Russian shepherding dog originally bred to kill bears. We sent the training subject with a chemical marker that resembles the smell of a reanimate.
Oh, come on, man.
Find our way, Brownie. Find our way.
No, 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 no.
Attack our way. Brownie, attack our way.
No, 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 no.
Wow, she's really going for it.
Yeah, we've had a lot of luck with this breed.
How many do you think you'll deploy this year?
Not enough.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. And any listeners who would like to learn more about adopting a security friend can contact the Berkshire Kennels for a free consultation. Reporting for Radio Living America in Westfield, Massachusetts, I'm Laura Sanders.
After the break, We'll sit down at the RLA discussion table to dissect the deteriorating events in Asia.
Granite State Tactical customers spoke, and here at Granite State Tactical, we listened. You said you needed a bug out bag with more duct tape, and we gave you more duct tape. You said you wanted a bag with better ration choices, and we made the changes. And when you said you liked the Churchill with its aluminum pouches of gin, but didn't like the added weight of the liquid alcohol, we went back to the drawing board. And now, we're proud to be partnering with...
Your Uncle Sally Joe! With Uncle Sally Joe's new micro-encapsulation process, you can evacuate with your liquor in powdered form and avoid the inconvenience of taking all those heavy bottles. After a long day on the run, you can kick back, pour a packet of powdered alcohol into 12 ounces of any liquid, and watch that boring bottle of water become 25% alcohol by volume. Just because you had to bug out doesn't mean you have to dry out.
With great flavors like Citrus Moab Blast, Superfruit Tropical Explosion, and Sweet Tea Canister Discharge, you can make your egress from danger something to look forward to. And remember, in a bug-out emergency, no one can take better care of you than you can.
Welcome back to the program. I'm joined today by Godfrey Pembroke, Editor-in-Chief of the Washington Spectator, Dr. Fang Huang of the Washington-based China Policy Institute, and retired United States Marine Corps Colonel William Feely. Thank you all for being on the program. I want this segment to be about the developments in Asia, but Godfrey, I must begin with you and ask, what's your take on President Stevenson's resignation?
I don't think your question is off topic. Look, what we are witnessing are obvious deceptions on the part of the Russian Federation. Do you really think they would test the boundaries as fearlessly as they do if there were a strong president? The second worst thing Stevenson could do at a moment like this is resign. The worst thing he could do is resign and announce he'll stay in the office until the end of the month. He's basically announcing to the Russians that there is no executive branch of the United States government at this time. The man can't even resign in disgrace properly. It's the perfect capstone on his presidency.
Colonel Feely, let me turn to you. Why do you think the Russians have held this ship for so long when experts argue that it could have been quarantined and released more quickly?
The whole notion that the ship couldn't have been diverted to Kamchatka Krai because it's an isolated port with risk of pandemic exposure is a lie on its face. So let's just get that out of the way. Kamchatka Krai may not be accessible by highway or rail, but it's an active military seaport, and it does an active business and commercial fishing. So to divert the Autumn Dawn there wouldn't have represented an increased security risk.
So what are you suggesting, sir?
It's obvious what I'm suggesting. They kept the ship for its cargo. Do you really think there's so much as a single soybean left on the Autumn Dawn? Do you think it's a coincidence that they sailed it over 1,500 nautical miles out of its way to a port that conveniently is the eastern terminus of the Trans-Siberian Railway, linking Vladivostok with Western Russia?
Dr. Huang, we heard some very inflammatory language from Chinese Ambassador Zhang. Do you think this is just political posturing?
I do not. The Sino-Russian Treaty of Friendship is the last tangible bond between these two nations. And the key feature of that treaty was a Russian guarantee of oil deliveries to China. But with much of the Eastern Siberia Pacific oil pipeline being unserviceable because of the reanimates, there is a little benefit to China from this treaty. And now, if Russia starts confiscating ships that China needs...
I apologize for interrupting, Dr. Huang. But if I may interject, Russia is looking at this the same way China is. That is to say, the Treaty of Friendship isn't worth the paper it's printed on at this point. I think Russia is looking at this as an every-man-for-himself situation. They stumbled on this ship. The real question is, what does the rest of the world want to do about it?
Colonel Feely, is there anything you're seeing that could suggest this could escalate beyond an exchange of hawkish rhetoric?
What my sources inside the Pentagon and State Department are telling me leads me to think that both sides are putting their money where their mouth is on this one. I'm being told that rail traffic in China has accelerated dramatically, with trains from cities like Tianjin, Ningbo, and Shanghai traveling to the cities of Fuyang and Dongfanghong.
And what's the significance of that?
Tianjin, Ningbo, and Shanghai are all population centers, industrial centers, and they're traveling to remote cities in northeastern China. But what Fuyang and Dongfanghong have in common is they are right over the border from the Russian seaport at Vladivostok. I'm being told that there is real concern that these are troop trains bringing elements of China's People's Liberation Army up to their border with Russia. Furthermore, I'm being told that the Qingyang battery factory in Shanghai is now working 24 hours a day. And the Chinese built a special rail spur to the factory practically overnight and have been running trains back and forth from the factory to Fuyang and Dongfanghong.
Dr. Huang, what's your take? Is Colonel Feely justified in his concern that this could become a bigger problem? And if so, where do you see it going?
Sadly, I think Colonel Feely is right in his assessment. I don't believe the language from the Chinese ambassador was just rhetoric. There is a huge risk for China if the colonel is right. Unlike the United States, China never localized its military. And I think the very thought of arming its citizens is a terrifying idea to the Chinese Communist Party. So, if they are moving parts of their army north to the Russian border, they are, in effect, leaving their major cities on the east coast undefended. Central China has been hit very hard by the pandemic, and a city like Tianjin or Ningbo could experience a spontaneous outbreak at any time.
The same thing is true for Russia, by the way. If they're moving troops east, it's at the expense of security in the west. What concerns me is this Russian naval force that was spotted heading out into the northeastern Pacific. This is the first major deployment we've seen of Russian naval assets since the beginning of the pandemic, and it has to leave everyone wondering just what they're up to.
Godfrey, what do you think America's response, or let me phrase it a different way, what do you think our role should be if this continues to develop into a crisis?
I think the American people would be apoplectic if the United States got involved in anything other than a diplomatic role. But even that would be difficult. I agree with the colonel. The Russians seized the cargo, and the Chinese are never going to get it back. But there's bigger risks here. With this naval force the Russians put to sea, do we need to worry that they're getting into the piracy business? That wouldn't just impact us. Canadian trade to China, much of which is conducted on U.S. ships, by the way, routinely travels near Russian territorial waters.
So are you telling us there's no solution?
I'm telling you, there's no easy solution. The United States could offer to lift the sanctions imposed on Russia in 2024, but would we be rewarding bad behavior if we did that? For their part, China will want an increased commitment from the United States, and that would require us to cut back on shipments to other countries.
I want to go around the table. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being a near-term peaceful resolution and 10 being armed conflict, where do you see this going? Dr. Huang?
10.
Colonel?
10.
Godfrey?
The dreamer in me says 9. The realist says 10.
Challenging times indeed. Thank you all for being here. That concludes today's program. For Radio Living America, I'm Brian Andrews asking that you stay safe, stay alert, and stay in the fight.